We're now moving on to the second matter on our oral argument calendar today. And so I'll invite the attorneys who are here to argue that case to come forward and sit at council table. We are reconstituting the panel as well. Take a few moments to settle in. Welcome to Judge Jessen, who has joined our panel. And when counsel are ready, if you want to take a seat, I will ask the clerk to call the case, the marshal to call the case, and I'll just have a few quick remarks. So, Marshal, go right ahead. All right, and again, thank you to both counsel for being here today. We appreciate having these arguments again in person, and very much appreciate having both of you present today and the well-written arguments that we've already received by the briefs. I'll make just a few remarks. I assume you're familiar with our procedures. If you did have any questions, you should feel free to ask them, but you should know a couple of things. First of all, of course, the time frame, I think, for your remarks is clear to you. Each side gets 15 minutes with a 5-minute rebuttal for appellant. We ask you, these proceedings are recorded and the audio is later available on our website, so we ask you to identify yourself as well as the client that you represent before you begin your remarks. And then with that, just keep an eye on the clock. It's a little bit different now. We have the two separate podiums, and then in the middle, the clock is in the middle. That can be a little hard for you to see. We appreciate that. Do your best, and don't worry about it. I will certainly call it to your attention if we're getting close to the time, and then, you know, we'll sort that out. But so don't be troubled by it. Just keep your eye on the clock. It tends to go fairly quickly. So with that, we're ready for counsel for appellant when you're ready.
May it please the court, Your Honor, Ryan Breeze of Zajac Law Firm on behalf of the appellant, Quentin Fanning. Before you, we bring today a child support matter with two issues of contention by the appellant. This came after a trial on custody and parenting time, and the child support part was then referred over to a magistrate for determination. The first issue before the court is the magistrate's application of a self-support reserve under Minnesota Statute 518A.42. This, as I understand, is a matter of first impression before the court in its interpretation of the statute. The statute is provided to ensure that each person that has to pay child support has enough money to support themselves. And so it sets the 120% of the federal poverty guidelines as a minimum standard that that person must retain in their payment of child support. So how the statute operates, though, is it does a calculation. After determining gross monthly income of the obligor, it then subtracts the 120 federal poverty guideline standard. What remains is what's considered for child support. If what they have left for their income after that is equal to or more than the calculated child support, then it is just what the calculated child support is. That's what it is. This is subdivision one of that statute. And it says that you would just continue on with a regular calculation under 518A.34. What happened in this situation is the magistrate did the calculation and somehow made the interpretation that because the calculated amount was $15 a month, that somehow invoked the statute to then reset it at a minimum support amount of $75 a month. However, that's incorrect, as the base amount is not the determining factor, but how much money they have left over for payment of support. In this situation, the parties' incomes was determined to be less, or exactly $100 apart. The parties have equal parenting time. As such, the parties have equal obligation and responsibility to care for the children. So the only determination then was how much that one party that earned $100 a month more than the other party should pay in child support. The calculation was $15 a month, and that was the appropriate calculation. So with that, then, the court's determination that this minimum support obligation applied was an error and was an errant application of it. And so in return, both his past support determination and his ongoing obligation was errant, is that it was set at $75 a month for all the past months as well as ongoing months.
But aren't we to interpret statutes not to reach an illogical result? And isn't it illogical if the person has, if he had less, then he would wind up paying more? I mean, it does talk about minimum support. So why should we agree with you?
Well, it actually is, because to reach that conclusion would require so many different elements. We're talking the obligor, so to speak, would have to be incredibly low income. We're also talking that the other party would have to be incredibly low income, or that the obligor would have very little parenting time. It takes into effect. And so the actual outcome of those situations where a party with low income would be actually paying more than Mr. Fanning here is incredibly rare, and in fact would be appropriate, because in that situation it would likely that that party only had 25% parenting time. So they aren't expending in each month money to take care for their children. In this situation, they have equal parenting time. They are each putting forth an equal amount of effort and resources to provide for the housing of the children, the food of the children, the activities of the children. And so I don't believe that it does produce an absurd result. I think, as I mentioned in the brief, the absurd result would be in a situation where the parties didn't have this $100 difference between them and were absolutely equal, the court's application here would still say, well, one of you should be paying a minimum support amount. We'll toss a coin and see who it is. And that would not be an appropriate result. The appropriate result would be you have equal income, you have equal parenting time, therefore you each have equal obligation, and that is exactly how 518.34 is to come out. This is how the calculation is to go, and therefore that is how it should result. All right, as to the second point, the court made a determination as to the respondent's income, and specifically they determined that though she received trust income, that none of that should be considered as ongoing income for calculation of her gross monthly income. The court did not go into detail as to why to that would be that. They were periodic payments that she received from the trust in large amounts of money, in fact, more than the appellant. The appellant also received trust income, for which the court determined that that was income to him, and yet they made the determination that hers was not income to her. Now, 518A.29 establishes gross income as any periodic payments that a party receives. The court has upheld that, yes, in fact, trust income received on periodic basis can be determined as part of gross monthly income. Now, in this situation, this is made more tenuous by the fact that it became apparent after the trial and in the child support submissions that the respondent had actually made misrepresentations both to counsel for the appellant as well as to the court. During the trial proceedings, the respondent was questioned on seeking reimbursement from the appellant regarding child tuition for
was
preschool.
Was that brought to the attention of the district court judge on review then?
It was on the motion for review, yes.
And didn't the judge conclude that the child support magistrate took that into account and said there's problems all over the place and this is what I'm going to do? And why is that not okay?
Because here we're talking about actual material misrepresentations made to the court. Now, Mr. Fanning...
But isn't that up to the court to determine? What you can claim they were material, but doesn't the district court judge have the authority to say, okay, I've reviewed all this, and I reviewed what was brought before the child support magistrate, and I'm finding that it was factored in. I don't think it's enough to change the outcome.
They do have that right, but I would say in this situation that it was, in fact, rose to the level of an abuse of discretion by the court. That we, especially considering the fact that it appears that the magistrate took into consideration the testimony stating that she had no control over the payments, that the payments were unknown when they would come, and if her statements there are going to be considered reliable, then the fact that she made other misrepresentations to the court should be taken into account into her credibility, undermining that initial determination that this was not regular periodic payments that she had
controlled. Isn't that what judges do all the time? They look at credibility and say, the person testifying here, I find that to be credible, but this other testimony I find not to be credible. I'm just not seeing how this is any different than credibility assessments, because that we see all the time.
Yes, and it does happen all the time. And in this situation, we have many clear-cut ones, several that didn't get in front of the court until the motion for review, because some of them had to do with disclosure that were made during discovery to counsel, and that we later then found out those disclosures were not, in fact, correct, and that she had actually received further monies than what she had disclosed in the discovery process.
And I just want to clarify, you're not trying to say because of these, what you're saying are material misrepresentations, that there should be a different standard of review. Okay, you're just saying it shows that this is an abuse of discretion, not
right.
That,
yes,
okay.
That this absolutely is an abuse of discretion, and therefore the court's determination that the trust income was not income for child support purposes was an error. So that is the ultimate position on that. If there are no more questions, I know this is a more brief issue. I'll conclude my comments at this time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
With that, we're ready to hear from the respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Katie Lammers, and I'm here representing the respondent in this matter, Joni Franzen. As the court is well aware, there are two main issues before us here today. The first is whether the child support magistrate and district court erred in their application of Minnesota Statute 518A.42 in setting a statutory minimum amount of child support. And the second issue, did the child support magistrate and district court err in its findings concerning the respondent's income? Your Honors, the answers to both of those questions are no. Jumping directly into the first issue, did the lower court err in setting a statutory minimum child support amount? The current child support guidelines in Minnesota are linked somewhat to the federal poverty guidelines. The court applies a rebuttable presumption that a child support order should not exceed an obligor's ability to pay. This court has said in Gully versus Gully that a district court's order regarding child support will be reversed only if the court is convinced that the lower court abused its broad discretion in resolving the matter in a manner that's against logic and the facts in the record.
So is it your position that this 518A.42 is clear or is it ambiguous?
Your Honor, it's ambiguous and it produces an absurd result.
But what makes it ambiguous? It says if it's less than this or more than that, that seems pretty easy to figure out. And then why isn't it the legislature's prerogative to fix it as opposed to ours?
Yes. So when I was looking and thinking about the point of the legislature in making 518A.42, the idea is that we want to provide, it's important to provide financial support for children. I think that's, a well-reasoned, very obvious, result that the legislature is seeking to perform. 518A.42 refers someone calculating child support back to 518A.34, but then 518A.34 cites us back to 518A.42. So when we're taking a look at the second part of the statute that requires the offset of the 120% of the poverty guidelines, in essence, what that creates is a situation that's present here where an obligor, had the court found that the appellant had lower income, he would have been paying the $75, and correctly so. So it's our position before this court that the district court not only had their discretion to be able to do that, but applying the statute as written creates an absurd result. I ran this child support calculation multiple times through the calculator.
Which words are you saying are ambiguous, and then how can they be interpreted? They have to be too reasonable. Right. Reasonable minds can look at it and come up with two different conclusions.
So
if you could point out the words in 518A.42 and the reference back to point 4.2 in point 3.4 is if point 4.2 is applicable. So I don't see that point 3.4 creates the problem unless there's something you want to point out to us.
I don't think 3.4 creates the problem either. I agree with you. I think the issue comes in, perhaps not that it's vague or ambiguous as much as it creates an absurd result. And I know the legislature has said that when they're creating laws, if it does come up with an absurd result, and I know we cited to this in our brief, that it's up to essentially this court and for us to take a look at how do we back ourselves out of that absurd result.
Counsel,
and I think that's more so what's before us today.
If I may.
Sure.
Typically when I think of statutory interpretation, if you find something that's ambiguous, if you find that it's ambiguous, then you can look, one, to legislative history, which I wonder if you did look at that. I didn't see any cite in your brief. And two, then you might get into, does this produce an absurd result? Not, I think the result is absurd, so therefore the statute's ambiguous, which I think is, at least from my understanding, the other way around. Could you address that for me, please?
I could. And, Your Honor, with respect to the legislative history, I went back so far as to look at before the child support guidelines changed in 2017 to come to this more shared incomes model, this statutory minimum support also remained even prior to that change of child support. And I believe that it's, you know, very well versed that the legislature wants to make sure that children are financially supported. And I think what they were attempting to do was essentially create a child support award that an obligor can pay. They're balancing that interest with the compelling interest of financially supporting children. And what has happened in doing that is essentially potentially lower income people are being penalized by having to pay higher child support obligations than someone with a higher income after applying that 120% of federal poverty guidelines. So, for example, if we were to take a look at somebody with an income of about $1,200 a month, and let's say we subtract the federal poverty guidelines in 2021, that was $1,288. So in this particular case before us today, under the regular 518A.34, the obligor would be paying $15. But if he had less income, the statutory self-support reserve would kick in and he'd be paying $75. So I think that's, you know, kind of the crux of my issue where the absurd result is created. I also would like to point out that this child support guidelines calculator themselves that everybody relies upon to calculate child support on line 22B is where if the statutory minimum child support amount kicks in, is applicable, that $75 if it's three kids, $50 if it's two kids, $25 if it's one child, appears on that line. So if you run child support guidelines and the calculator itself says, okay, based upon the calculator's interpretation of the law, this, you know, minimum support amount doesn't kick in, it doesn't appear on the child support guidelines calculator. Yes.
If I may follow up, appellant suggests that this interplay before us between 518A.34 and 518A.42 presents an issue of first impression. Do you agree with that? And if so, should we be issuing a precedential opinion?
Your Honor, I do agree with that. And I was wondering about why perhaps that was. So in my research and preparing for my brief and preparing for today, I don't know if it's just never been something that anyone has been able to afford to bring this far. Taking a look at the way that the district court and the discretion that they have in issuing child support orders, I believe that they do have a wide discretion, and that might be another reason why it's never made it this far, Your Honor. But I do agree that this issue is one of first impression before us. I defer to the court as to whether you decide to issue a precedential opinion on that or not. I think it probably depends on the way that you're looking at these issues. But I do agree with that comment, yes. So, Your Honor, even if the absurdity of the way that this statute is constructed and the ultimate outcome isn't apparent before you, I'm still asking that in this case, you affirm this child support award because doing so would support, again, the overarching policy of keeping children financially taken care of and making sure that children's needs are met. And again, looking at the plain language of the statute in 518A.34 subdivision H, that's the one I was talking about referring us back to the 518A.42. 518A.42 says that if it applies, the court shall use the minimum amount of child support, the statutory minimum amount of child support. Clearly, Your Honor, the obligor in this case can afford to make the payment. He's not making that argument that he is unable to make it. And given the absurd result that applying the calculator or applying the statute and not the calculator in this case would produce, I'm asking that you affirm the district court's order regarding the facts before you here today. Unless you have any other questions about issue one, Your Honors, I'll move to the second issue.
Let me just ask one final question. I'm looking at 518A.42, subdivision 1, print C. And there it uses the language, if, you know, a couple of other things, then the court shall apply a reduction to this child support, which would suggest to me that perhaps this provision is really to reduce, not to increase. You know, could you help me with that language?
Under subsection C, you're correct. So essentially, what if they need to reduce it down until the support order is equal to the obligor's income for support, it gives the hierarchy about how you're supposed to reduce that down. So I agree that the way that the statute is written is designed to allow for an obligor to be able to meet their monthly expenses. And that, I think, is kind of the crux of the absurdity of it, where we have people with higher income who could meet that minimum child support of $75, actually then being directed to potentially pay less than someone with that lower income who is paying at the statutory minimum. I think that's the circular place where we're kind of going back and forth, Your Honor. With respect to the second issue, the lower court did not err by finding the respondent's family trust payments were gifts and not income, and therefore not including them as income for purposes of child support was proper. Your Honors, I've already touched on this issue. To put it plainly, this court defers to the lower court with respect to credibility issues. The Walsh case cited by the appellant in their brief, I believe, is misstated as far as the proposition that trust income is always available for income for child support. I don't believe it stands for that broad proposition. Though in Welsh, the mother acknowledged that she had trust payments. She acknowledged that she received those as periodic monthly payments. They were undisputed. The issue in Walsh was really whether that evidence of mother's trust income would preclude any consideration or finding that she was voluntarily underemployed. So in that, the facts of that case are very different than the case here at bar. The lower court made multiple findings after taking testimony and reviewing extensive records as to why the respondent's trust payments were gifts and not income. The court found that my client is not a trustee. She has no control over the disbursements. And with respect to these trust disbursements, the court also found that they were sporadic, that they had occurred, you know, over a multitude of years in wildly differing amounts. And all of those findings were sufficient to support what the magistrate found and the district court ultimately affirmed. There's been a lot made of the discovery responses that were put forth by my client. Every single thing was turned in prior to the March 4th, 2021 child support hearing. Both parties were put under oath. Both counsel questioned both parties and had the opportunity to cross-examine both parties. And at no point was there anything left undisclosed prior to that hearing. Additionally, counsel for appellant repeatedly talked about subpoenaing either the grandfather or subpoenaing potentially the trustee for further proceedings, and that never happened. I mean, clearly they had the opportunity to do that. Both people were represented by counsel. So the crux of the argument, again, seems to be that essentially respondent's disclosures demonstrate her lack of credibility, and that is so egregious enough to produce an abuse of discretion. And that's just simply not the case here, Your Honors. Appellate courts defer to the district court's credibility, and I ask that you do the same here as well. In conclusion, I'm asking you to find that the lower court did not err in the application of 518A.42 in this specific case at bar. It was not contrary to logic. It's not contrary to the facts that are on the record. And I'm also asking that you find that the district court and the child support magistrate appropriately handled the respondent's income and affirm that portion as well, Your Honor. I have a little bit of time left, so if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer those. Otherwise, I would yield the rest of my time.
It appears that we have no further questions for you. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Yeah. And counsel for appellant, we are ready for 5 minutes of rebuttal if you choose. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Your Honors. One thing counsel stated, her hypothetical is incorrect in its calculation, and this goes back to what I was saying, as there are many factors that go into this. She states that if our client was making less money, he would actually be paying more, which is incorrect. How the statute works and how the calculations would have worked in this situation is if our client was making less money, then the respondent would have been paying him child support because that's how the calculation goes. They have equal parenting time, so equal obligation, and if she had more resources than him, then she would in fact be paying him, not that he would be paying more if it was a lower amount that he was earning. And so that hypothetical and the whole argument that it produces an absurd result is, again, incorrect. There are many factors going into how the calculation goes, and again, this is established to ensure that each party has enough to support themselves as they provide for the obligation. Again, her reference to 518.34 and ensuring that children have sufficient financial support, that happens here. The parties have equal time. They're equally responsible for ensuring that their children have enough resources, food, everything of that sort, and they have the equal resources up to the $100 difference. That's why there ends up with such a small child support amount, is because there is such little difference in each of their obligation, both with parenting time and with resources. And so I would again argue that the court's misapplication here was that they went to subdivision 2 when they should have stayed at subdivision 1 that said there is, in fact, enough money that he can pay the calculated amount. And in reference to the child support calculator, lines 15B through 17 do that calculation of the ability to pay and whether there should be an adjustment. And in the court's calculation that they provided to the order in line 16, it says no adjustment necessary because he didn't meet that self-support reserve, so there should not have been any adjustment made to it. As Your Honor noted, 1C does note a reduction, and that is that in-between amount, where if they have sufficient income to pay the calculated amount, then they pay that amount. If they have this in-between amount, and I'm sorry, I can't cite the exact numbers, but if they have this in-between amount, there's a reduction. So if they say they have $150 available for support from that self-support reserve, but the obligation is $300, then it's reduced to that $150. And then if they then hit the mark where they don't have any, then they go back to that $50 or $75 minimum support reserve. So if there's any other questions on that issue... And then referring back to the second issue, I'll just again say that gross income under 518.29 is to be considered any periodic payments. It frequently includes bonuses, things that are infrequent, unknown if they're going to come through. The court will provide averages for these to determine. Mm-hmm. And in this case, they used Mr. Fanning's trust income for a determination of income. And in this case, they should have used respondents as well. There's nothing further. I'll conclude my remarks.
There doesn't appear to be anything further. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We appreciate very much hearing from both lawyers today, and thank you for that. This matter is now submitted to this court for a decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory time frame. So with that, the two matters that we're hearing today in the courtroom have been concluded. We will recess. We have a Zoom argument scheduled at 1 o'clock, and as well as our non-oral calendar. So again, thank you for your arguments today.